Now here we go.
Most people really don't believe me. I know that. I live with that every day of my life. I've been pretty well tuned out by the media. If anything is remembered of me, I guess in the general world, what they remember is, haha, rectal probe, or he's a disturbed man, he's crazy, or something like that. But the truth is, I am not crazy. This is about emotions and feelings more powerful than human beings experience. It's about living and facing such experiences, and it is hard. It is real hard.
Bad things have happened to people from my childhood who I returned to meet again. I think I was traumatized in early childhood, and I don't think I'm real alone. I think the whole neighborhood was bruised as if an invisible fist had come.
And also, I want to go home.
I don't think that I did it. I don't know what I did exactly connected with this in terms of intelligence work.
I can't get that face out of my head.
Apparently nothing. I can't remember anything at all. Not even a snatch of anything.
Really?
You will not live if you join the CIA. But I am a very conventional person. I was not able to control what happened. As you're undoubtedly aware, there's a whole school of thought in our world that they're evil. And they wouldn't disagree with that for a minute. Dark side and evil are complicated issues. We make the dark side evil by the way we deal with it, and the grays will test you and test you and test you. The more you work with the dark side, the more successful you are, the darker they get. Until you find the only thing is surrender.
Because I cannot do a thing about this. I don't even want to look up at this.
The only thing is surrender.
Can we help you stop screaming? Can we help you stop screaming?
This was in my sampan years, which I won't even get into all that stuff, but it was during that period where I had a lot of intense dreams and a lot of mainly hypnopompic instead of hypnagogic experiences, where I would come out of a dream partially and be in a half dream, half waking state, and still be dreaming but also experience the room around me, sort of thing, a combined sort of state. I found myself like in a desert town. It looked kind of a lot like the like mud huts and things that you see in again another movie reference, A Fistful of Dollars. If that calls to mind any visual references, the town seemed to be based on that. And there, I saw three men ahead of me on a dirt road, and it appeared that there were two confronting another man, and the man they were both confronting was wearing like a hooded robe. And one of the men had a sword, and they were arguing with the man in the robe. And the man in the robe, to prove a point, raised his hand and told the one with the sword to chop his arm off. He chops his arm off, and this might be a Star Wars reference. First thing I remembered was, you know, when the person gets his, you know, all these movie references always pop up in my dreams and you know, my interpretations of things, so I never know, you know, how I've actually altered them. But, you know, where the I don't know what the hell it was, some creature gets his arm cut off in the bar. But anyways, he cuts the man's arm off, but from underneath the robe, he produces another arm, and he cuts that arm off. And then from underneath the robe, he produces another arm, and he cuts that arm off, and he just continually does that. And then I realize that this man in the robe is Jesus Christ, and he's doing this to prove a point that no matter how many times you cut parts of this him off, that you can never actually cut that part off, that it's still, he still remains whole. And when I got that point, my brain, I had just read, like, I believe it was maybe perhaps the first book that was released about it's a collection of essays about the holographic paradigm. I realized that that was a lesson that I had to learn, and the lesson of that was that the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, to go back to crucifixion, didn't mean, you know, the whole sin and payment for sin and redemption and all that stuff. What that was a holographic metaphor for no matter how much you damaged this man, he still remained whole and could not be destroyed.
Right.
And it was as if I got a sense at that point that I had, like, cracked some sort of code, at least, or something like that, and a voice told me that because of that, I would be given a present of being allowed to witness the actual crucifixion. And at that point, the dream, like, instantly changed. It was like I was actually standing in front of Jesus Christ, crucified on the cross. And, you know, I tried to look up at him, but it felt like gravity was pulling me down. I had to get down on my knees and very hard to look up, but I forced myself to look up. That's, you know, that gravity sort of increased. I felt like I was coming back into my body, and this is what I'm kind of getting to, waking up. You know, I started to feel the weight of my body, and that's probably what it was. And just continually, you know, watched Christ on this cross, and there was, I can't remember exactly can't really describe the imagery, but it was, possibly again based on another film, but that whole bit in here, and I don't know, I wish I could come up with your actual reference in here though, but that's what that reminded me of. And it again goes back to the idea of, you know, the species as a hydra and the individual as the different heads, extensions of a central force. You can kill each part, the whole remains. You can kill, you know.
Right, and that's the Christ is the...
Right.
Humanity is Christ's body, that idea.
Yeah. So, you know, that set off sparks in that direction, and, you know.
Well, there's a lot of stuff there. I mean, you just put an awful lot of stuff on the table. Yeah, which should we sample first, huh?
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to decide. Well, let me just say what came into my head, and Keith can interrupt me if he wants, if he dares. The severing of the limbs that keep growing back, we didn't exactly say they grow back, but basically he always had another one, and that's like lizards, right? You chop off a lizard's tail and it grows back, that regeneration of the organism. And the witnessing of the crucifixion reminded me of something I'd heard in E.T. lore, which is that the, you know, that these beings, if we can even call them that, but wherever this stuff comes from, one of the things that's come through is the idea that they created Jesus, right? And I've even heard that they filmed the crucifixion, like they were there with their little alien technology, and they got the footage of the crucifixion, which presumably, if you really get up to the high levels, you get to see, you know, the home movie, The Crucifixion.
Super 8, so
kind of remind me of that. And then the thing of the holographic universe, I think, is the main theme that you're bringing up. And that's, actually a book by Michael Talbot, The Holographic Universe, who was a friend of Whitley Strieber, and who greatly influenced Strieber, I think. That book greatly influenced him. And in fact, at the Mother of Strangle website, their latest piece, or Heinrich's latest piece, or Clifton Strange, or whatever name he's going by now, is about the parallels between the key and the holographic universe. It's kind of presenting the argument that Strieber took a lot of material out of Talbot's book and incorporated it into the key, the supposed dialogue with the master of the key. So it seems like it's on topic. And I read the Holographic Universe some years ago, and it had a big impact on me. I gave it to my mother even at one point. And I think it is a very influential book, I think. At the very least, it sort of encapsulates a great number of these beliefs, the New Age beliefs, in a very persuasive and impactful way. But, of course, this material is material that I'm becoming so suspicious of now, even though I've had my own experiences like you're describing there, Phil, and I've got plenty to go on that makes me think that this is a real model for reality, the holographic model. But at the same time, I kind of distrust it, you know what I mean?
That's one thing I definitely understand is distrust.
Right. And it isn't my daily experience, not really. My daily experience is very much being separate and of being restricted to my body and identified with my body. And so then what was coming to my mind when you were describing the holographic experience was, like, if besides it being some possible potential for us as consciousness, or some possible state that we can enter into through when we sleep, through astral projection or whatever is going on there, like, what's the equivalent in our experience? What is our equivalent in our experience of being an extension of another being or another body? I mean, that's...
I would guess, just the family experience, even. I mean, you're part of the family, and the family itself is a unit, and each individual is separate, but they're still a separate part of a complete unit.
Right, but prior to that, even, was this the child in the womb?
Well, the mother,
right.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the primary experience. I mean, I don't want to interrupt your or break your train of thought too much, but one thing, I read a lot about the bond between the mother and child after a child is born and the separation there. Well, that's later. The real wholeness, the real separation comes when you leave the womb and you don't know that the mother exists. There's no mother, there's no self, there's no anything but the whole in the womb. So, yeah, that whole womb experience to me is what really, the most powerful part that it really goes back to. And the draw is not so much, this desire for oneness with the mother and after being born, but, that desire for that womb experience,
For the womb experience.
Which, talk about something that's completely unconscious that you can't access memories of.
Sure. Well, it's unconscious in terms of mentally unconscious, but
right.
The question is,
what
is consciousness?
Body. Yeah,
the body is kind of like a fetus is still a separate, right. Well, not exactly separate, but it has form. It's a formed body even before it's born in the womb. So it has consciousness. No, it is aware of temperature and heartbeat, and it's getting sensory data.
Mm-hmm.
And being affected by it. So that is conscious, isn't it? And that is, and where there's consciousness, there's some sort of point of view. There's some sort of separation, seems to me. Like, so isn't it, it's all sort of relative, like a spectrum of...
Oh, yeah, everything. From, being, yeah.
But there's no difference, though. I mean, so there's no context. So there's no... I mean, if it's all sort of the same, if you said there's heartbeat and so forth, yeah, but it's pretty much consistent. So there's no real difference there, no change.
Well, what about if the mother smokes a cigarette or drinks in a pint of gin?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that would change things.
Of course, that's the discordant element right there. Or how about if the parents have sex, make tender, sweet love while the baby's in the womb?
Yeah.
Not necessarily a negative. It might add, but it would add something.
Or just right. Emotions, I suppose, yeah. Could alter the conditions.
Mm. Yeah, I think the primary... Because the environment that a fetus is in is the womb, is the mother's body. That is its environment, just as for us, our environment is the world. I mean, potentially the whole universe. It might just be our little, you know, dusty apartment, but it's whatever. The world is our environment. For the fetus, it's the mother's body. And so, just as if the elements in our environment, if it's hot, or cold weather, or if there's police banging on the door, or if we can't pay our rent, or if we run out of food, all of these factors are influencing our experience of ourselves. For the infant in the womb, or the unborn child, I presume that its environment, its experience of itself is determined by what the mother's experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
If she's happy, if she's sad, if she's sober, if she's drunk, if she's cold, if she's warm.
Stress, yeah.
Stress is the major one.
Yeah, a greater, more intense experience of oneness with the mother. You are part of the mother. And, you know, you mentioned the spectrum. My child isn't just at one stage of development in the womb. You know, starts off barely a, you know, I don't know, single-celled creature, just a little thing growing in there, you know? So, you know, when does this experience begin? At conception, or, you know, are you only this theoretical fetus inside a womb in the last month? You know,
mm-hmm.
Really, how far back do you go? So far back that there's, you know, really nothing.
Well, sure, yeah.
Because the mother's there. You know, you're growing out of an egg, which pre-existed before you, you know, before your parents had sex inside your mother and, you know, sperm cell inside your father, so.
Right. Well, if you want to follow those threads, then you would be split in two at a certain point.
Your
father's scrotum.
Exactly. your mind would split in two if you try to, like, reach the ultimate stage of understanding of these things.
Except that your mind, presumably, would get that far.
Right,
anyway.
Yeah, there's so many, you know, only so much conception thought you can do about really any of this, about anything, before you're beating a dead horse. You're wasting your time, basically.
Well, yeah, okay, but you don't have to be so ambitious either, because what you're describing, yeah, there's a spectrum, and that spectrum of between undifferentiated consciousness, if any at all, and our separate ego selves that we're now confined to, more or less, does the spectrum continues even after birth, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's this whole series of experiences that determine what kind of transition we make from this harmonious, undifferentiated, interconnected experience of ourselves to a separate identity, fighting for survival or happiness. How we make that transition is determined by the environment, first of all, of the mother's body, and then the environment that we're born into, that is also, obviously, the mother's body is, at least ideally, is central to that environment even after we're born.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that experience, because we're talking about trauma, of course, which is the,
right.
the main subject matter of this Crucial Fictions, like to what extent, I mean, how intense is the trauma, but perhaps even more importantly, to what extent are we kind of buffered or held throughout the trauma so that we're able to assimilate it and integrate it and actually adapt to it? Because you can't avoid the trauma. It's inevitable.
Right.
Well, yeah, to me that speaks of, it's really, how bad is trauma? Trauma is not bad. It's a natural thing that cannot be avoided. It must be dealt with in some way, of course. Existence is trauma. Life is trauma. So for me, using the word trauma too much, or at least, well, I guess too much, I would say, to me, at least in my mind, it builds up a sense that, wait a minute, this seems to suggest that trauma is bad and therefore something we must avoid, and there is a better way to be that we can propose that's separate and apart from trauma completely, which to me is totally unrealistic and would never happen. You know, it comes to me through talking about trauma. Yeah, right, exactly. But it's, you know, there's, you know, that whole idea of proposing a better way to be, if that's really what you're headed towards, not you, but I mean just a person in general, then I don't care what you have to say about the trauma. Tell me what you propose instead, and that's really the topic of discussion.
But maybe it isn't, though. I mean, maybe because trauma is like, yeah, I think there's, As with so many things, it tends to, one extreme leads to another. So, to the extent that there's been this denial of trauma throughout history, the sort of cavalier attitude is not even the right word, but this kind of neglectful attitude towards children, whether it's sending them up chimneys or murdering them, sacrificing them to Jehovah, whatever it is, you know, the kind of treatment that children have been subjected to, has as symptomatic of an absolute indifference to or denial of trauma actually being a formative factor. And so then, but now we're in a culture today where to some extent there's been a swing, the pendulum swung the other way, and yeah, there is a lot of talk about trauma and about, you know, there's a sort of kind of victim perspective on things. But so it isn't necessarily either or, right? It's not about trauma being good or bad. That's just that's a trap that you always fall into. And if you talk about anything, like bring it back to aliens, this tendency we have is so irresistible, and that is fortified by Hollywood and the whole media complex, that it's either Close Encounters of the Third Kind and E.T. or it's alien, right? That they're either evil incarnate or they're pure innocent goodness, we know that that's absurd. You can't separate anything into categories of good and evil, whether it's beings or whether it's concepts or whether it's experiences. They just are what they are, and actually what varies is how we meet them, how we actually interact with whatever that experience or whatever that being is right. Going to determine whether our experience is good or bad, and that's just entirely subjective. So some people, I mean, some, like Native Americans, use trauma to, well, in theory, to as a part of a vision quest and in order to individuate or become enlightened, as opposed to whatever guys fighting in Iraq who end up with post-traumatic stress disorder and just can't function. Mm-hmm. But they're not necessarily, the experience of the trauma isn't necessarily that different so much as the context in which it's being experienced.
Right.
Right.
Well, there's a more protective, you know, an American Indian example, there'd be a more protective, controlled environment where you engineer a trauma that really can't lead to someone's maiming or death so much. I mean, there can be injuries, of course. You have to take people to a certain edge so that it's a genuine trauma, so whatever it is that you're using the trauma for would actually be effective. But versus war, where, you know, there's no guarantee that you're going to come back with your legs or your life or whatever, you know, or your mind.
Right, and even also the there isn't a context to understand it, because you go to war, you might have this idea about you're fighting for home and country, but when you get there, you realize it's all a big lie, and it's all, you can't actually maintain that illusion. It's going to be the first casualty of war, as innocents, they say. And so then you no longer have the context, the mental tools to deal with the trauma. It just becomes this meaningless, senseless chaos, as opposed to the Native American who, at least potentially, he trusts the elders, he trusts the tradition that he's part of. And so although the physical trauma would be roughly the same, body being pierced, extreme pain, mutilation, etc., the psychological, the context is totally different.
Right.
And I think that's probably true for children as well. I don't think that it's necessarily that the children who grow up into adults who are crippled by trauma, that the trauma was necessarily worse so much as that the context that they that the trauma occurred to them within the environment, and that the amount of understanding that they had and that was provided to them, I think that that may well be the crucial factor.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing I have, but you have to ask yourself, why would a child's immune system shut down? It was something designed to frighten us. I think I was traumatized in early childhood, and I don't think we're alone.
Okay. Now here we go. There's a whole school of thought in our world that they're evil. And they wouldn't disagree with that for a minute. And the Greys will test you and test you and test you. Will test you and test you and test you.
And you see the anger that I still feel about being raped by them. And right now, as I sit here speaking to you, I have pain there. Pain that never completely goes away and cannot really gotten rid of. I mean, not without a lot of drugs, which I don't intend to take. Because of the injury that never totally healed. Never.
Yeah, I mean, frequently I will feel myself programmed by nature. As much as human agencies or just society itself or myself or the media or whatever. You know, we're filled with urges and desires and thoughts and dreams and behaviors that we didn't actually originate, that we didn't create or decide upon.
But I guess I just would make a distinction between what I would call natural programming and people going, inside other people's heads and messing about.
Right. Right. Well, that would be what the people are doing would be aping nature. They would look at nature, become aware of what nature is actually doing and thinking, I want to get in on that action. And then, going in and artificially creating similar situations.
Yeah. It's based on, what I would argue is an extreme form of hubris. Where, okay, I know better.
Right.
This is for the good of, and even these examples of the Native Americans that you were talking about earlier, I question the validity of that.
Sure. Well, isn't it to do with trying to use trauma to heal trauma? Like trying to use a nail to knock out a nail, as the Spanish say. Which sometimes works, but I think by and large you just end up with two nails stuck in.
Yeah, it's a gamble. I don't don't think it pays off.
Well, bringing it to aliens, if we can, the visitors, or you know, these beings that may or may not be interacting with humanity, it does seem like something is there, like it's not all just psyops and hallucinations, right?
Maybe.
Well, my sense, I guess we could talk about that, maybe. Mm-hmm. But my sense is, yeah, there's definitely some real and even physical or semi-physical presence here. Not to say separate from humans, because as we pointed out, it's really difficult to discern what, if anything, is separate from anything. But what I was going to bring up was how, and I don't think Strieber's alone in this, that the idea that there are these beings who are engineering our evolution through trauma. So then, and that does overlap with these psyops and the mind control programs. You know, you're saying this is hubris, but I was pointing out that this is also how nature operates. Nature is one series of traumas. It begins with a trauma, it ends with a trauma. Everything is expendable. You know, matter is just this great machine that basically just devours itself in order to reproduce, in order to continue and further itself. But really, it is just this self-devouring machine. And we glorify nature, we romanticize it, probably more than ever nowadays. And yet, and this is kind of a conundrum or a question that I'm coming up against more and more, like Phil was saying, well, if this is the wrong way, what's the right way? Or if this is, you know, what's the context of, if we're going to talk about trauma and all the rest of it, as somehow wrong or harmful, then what's the measure for the right way? So this kind of the same with the MK Ultra and all those guys. We can see more or less clearly that what they're doing is wrong. Let's say that it's unproductive at best. And it's driven by trauma, unconscious trauma. So what about the aliens, or whatever the hell they are? I mean, what are they doing? Like, are they, like Whitley believes, that they belong to some higher order of being and they work by ancient laws, quote-unquote. So they're part of nature. Gee whiz, well, they must be perfect. But then if we look at nature, nature's pretty fucked up too. Really, I mean, lions eat their own cubs because they don't want to get replaced, like Saturn. How harmonious is that? How that seems like a pathology. Like it is pathologic. Like if our definition for pathology is, I mean, what definition can we have for pathology except what goes against nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then, if you look at nature and see it's pathological too, where does that leave us?
Well, first of all, I would take issue with your use of the term that nature is a machine. I think you're playing. I think that's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't use I wouldn't use that term, because I think that's a mischaracterization, and it's not productive.
Well, because machine has negative connotations for you, but if, I mean, machines that...
But machines operate in a very different way than a natural being.
Well, what's your evidence? Like, what's your definition of a machine and how it operates? How is that different from how the biological organism...
Well, you can take a machine apart and you can examine its component pieces, and you can understand exactly what's going on. I don't really think that's true of natural beings.
Well, a lot of people would disagree with you, probably. A lot of, you know, scientists.
Yeah, but that's getting to the very point that I was trying to make.
Yeah, that's which is...
That's the whole mentality, that we are just simply machines that can be deconstructed, its component parts, and you can get to the bottom of it. I just disagree, fundamentally.
Okay, well, I see that. I get that. But can't you take it the other way and say that if we are just machines, or if nature is just a machine, I didn't say just, but if nature is a machine, then machines are also part of nature. Therefore, just as well as comparing nature to a machine is taking the soul out of nature, you could say that it's putting the soul in the machine.
Well, that's a pretty dangerous idea, I would say.
Well, we're all about dangerous ideas, so we're still getting away from dangerous ideas.
I mean, now you're entering into, let's just upload the consciousness into the machine, and...
Well, I'm not, though. I mean, you're kind of jumping ahead now because you've got privileged insight to what's to come, but I'm not... this is... My question is still out there. Like, if...
But it's based on I just disagree with the first part of the syllogism. If nature is a machine, well, it's not.
Well, nature devours itself, whether you call it a machine or not. You just look around what nature does. Basically, it destroys everything it creates, without exception. So we're all expendable. We're all just grist for the mill, everything. That was my point. And more to the point, even, that it seems to do it wantonly and unnecessarily. Like, there's all kinds of what would appear to be pathological behavior in nature, except that it's nature, and as I say, if you say that nature's pathological, then the word pathological becomes meaningless, because what are we going to compare it to? What would be non-pathological behavior?
Well, I guess you'd have to enter into the area that the whole sort of philosophical idea that although we're part of nature, that we have, a higher sort of intelligence that's able
to be non-pathological.
Well, that's able to see things in a broader context.
But do you mean so that we can see that nature isn't pathological, or that we can depathologize nature, or our own nature?
Well, that we can make decisions that individual decisions that minimize the negative effects of whatever pathologies are inherent.
Well, that's Lloyd DeMouse's thing, and it's fascinating. Like, he's saying that improved childcare, in a real sense, not socially, but individual improvement of individual relations between mothers and children, and fathers and mothers, would change the course of history, would reshape culture, and so what he seems to be presenting is the idea that the only true evolutionary determinant is free will, is the ability to actually overcome one's own patterns and not react. Not if you're abused, not react to that abuse by abusing others, to forbear, to surrender in such a way that you're able to gradually, or that we're collectively able to gradually change the shape of the human psyche and therefore of human nature. I don't know. I mean, it's a radical idea.
I don't think you can change human nature, but you can make choices.
Right. Well, all of this, plus the talk of trauma, and if this is the wrong way, then what's the right way? All of that, to me, I always come back to compassion, basically. You can't avoid the trauma, but through compassion, you can get over the effects of the trauma. And that whole consciousness, becoming conscious of these things, free will and individual action based upon compassion, which comes from a bodily experience that is rooted in the body and completely present and in touch with trauma and suffering around you and within you and everyone else, leads you to alter your behavior, perhaps only slightly, but to start on the path towards that area of at least compensating somehow for, or somewhat, for the effects of trauma, which, you know, the inevitable trauma that life brings. And even manufactured trauma, artificial trauma, whatever you would call, you know, these trauma, you know, affected by these agencies and religion. I mean, any of those things, like, you know, I mean, you mentioned sacrificing children to Jehovah earlier, and, you know, there's the whole, you know, story of Abraham, and, you know, he and his wife were older, and, you know, they thought, you know, they would never have another child, or I can't remember if she was barren, or I, you know, hate the Bible crap and everything, but, you know, they have the kid, and, you know, it's a surprise, and everybody's surprised, but God comes and tells Abraham to sacrifice the child. So he takes him out to sacrifice it. And right before he plunges the knife in his heart, God comes to him and says, "Wait a minute, Abe, it was just a joke. Stop. I was tested." Kind of thing, you know? Now, I'd have to get the actual reference in the book. I, you know, due to my fights with my struggle with my brother, trying to, you know, figure out what the hell the Bible's about, basically, myself, to figure out what he's talking about. Read several books about biblical archaeology. And one of the points that they made, and I hope I remember this point correctly, I'd have to come up with the exact reference for you later. I can't really come up with it off the top of my head now, was that there was no, for the time that Abraham supposedly lived, there's no evidence that the Hebrew people actually existed. There were no real permanent encampments. It seemed that if he existed, he was part of a proto/pre-Canaanite tribe. And the Canaanites, of course, practiced child sacrifice, supposedly. I think the ritual, the rule was, you know, you have to sacrifice your firstborn.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if this Abraham is, you know, if we want to rewrite the whole biblical story, if this Abraham is a pre-Canaanite who lives in a culture that believes in child sacrifice for whatever reason, he didn't have to have a voice of God come to tell him and sacrifice your son. It could just be part of your culture. Well, we had a kid. Now I'm supposed to go sacrificing, right. You know, just doing it purely out of sociocultural, political, whatever you want to call it, religious conditioning / programming.
Mm.
Take the kid out, sacrifice the kid. But before he kills the kid, he looks in his eyes, and for a second, he's overcome with compassion, a compassion that would have been quite rare in a society that believes in sacrificing its own children. So he's overcome with this sense of do not kill the child, as if so much so, this resistance to sacrificing the child, that it's as if he heard a voice speak.
Mm.
And
yeah.
He has to go back with the kid. Now he's going to be reviled. He has to come up with a story as to why he didn't sacrifice the kid, because if he comes back with that kid unsacrificed, that's going to anger the god, and something bad's going to happen to the tribe, so they're going to be after him now. He comes back and says, no, God came to me and he told me, don't sacrifice the kid. In fact, he was testing me and he told me, let's get the fuck out of here. Anybody who doesn't believe in sacrificing the kids, come with me. So he leads off. Goes off, leaves this society, and based upon that moment of compassion and this belief that God's commandment is don't sacrifice your kids anymore, stop doing that, building on that, and you come up into, you know, the monotheism and, you know, getting away from, you know, sacrifice and all those things. Of course, the Jews, they go off, and then, you know, I don't know how many, 100 years later, 200 years later, whatever it is, after the imprisonment in Egypt and the Exodus and the escape. Well, they go back and the Canaanites have now built up and now they're an evil culture because they still do their child sacrifice. And God told them, you know, kill these evil Canaanites because they sacrifice children. You know,
Right, so they were sacrificed.
Supplant that. You know, sacrifice them. Exactly, exactly. Which to me, it doesn't ring true. That's my argument with my brother anyways. The fact that, you know, well, you know, that they would do that, and his defense was, but they were evil and they sacrificed children. It's like, well, God also said slaughter every damn one of them, men, women, and children. You know, so it's like, well, don't burn them in the fire, Moloch's statue, or I can't remember exactly the method of sacrifice, something involving a statue and a fire.
Sure.
And killing the kids by fire, but instead cut them apart by swords because that's for compassion or something like that. To me, that doesn't ring true. But that idea of, you know, if the whole Abraham myth would be based on something real, that would be. And again, all I'm saying is it goes back to that moment of compassion. It's that.
Well,
compassion.
Right. Well, it could have just been a moment, couldn't it? Like a moment.
It could be a completely transformative moment. Yes.
Yeah, and then maybe that was a forerunner of Jesus 2,000 years later, who actually did bring in a new law, mercy not sacrifice.
Right, but he also did it by being the last sacrifice, so he sort of validated that whole sacrificial idea, which, again, I would.
So, yeah, here we are 2,000 years later, still sacrificing.
Right, now. Because our guy who stopped it did it through sacrifice? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, to me, you know, if
well, I think it's an individual thing, I think, is what it is. So what you were describing with Abraham was this moment of empathy, compassion, stroke empathy, which is, I think there's something there, like we're talking about us all being interconnected and all just part of this one organism, which is nature, which is this kind of self-sacrificial organism that does see all the parts as essential, but also as equally expendable, because you can and must sacrifice the parts for the whole. Right, the whole can't continue without sacrificing the parts. So on the one hand, like, total interconnectedness is kind of ruthless and selfless in a particular kind of way, where the self has no value, the individual has no value. But on the other hand, if you have the other extreme of that, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to flatten this out now, but it seemed like what you're describing was the ability to see the other as oneself.
Right.
It's like the bridge between experiencing yourself as totally separate, and therefore you don't have to consider the other parts because it's just every man for himself. Mm. That's kind of the psychopathic way. And then there's the totally undifferentiated from the whole, which is kind of like there's no compassion there, there's no empathy, because there's no sense of individuality at all to experience it. The bridge in between those two is you do experience yourself as separate, but you're able to have empathy for the other.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you hold both concepts. It's a more complex, you know, idea, because you have to hold two thoughts in your head at once.
Yeah, and it may be that it's incredibly delicate balance. It's just incredibly difficult, as an understatement, to actually be in that. To walk that razor's edge and be in that state of actually experiencing yourself as an individual, while at the same time being aware of your interconnectedness to others, right, without getting totally swallowed up by it.
Exactly.
It goes down deep into my own unconscious fears of the grays, that they are not emotional creatures, that they are brilliant animals rather than any kind of civilized being as we would understand it.
They are here. You have to understand that. They are here.
is this opens up in your life, and it may, especially if you begin to live into too deeply into the time when this whole world is gripped by the terror of impending death. Billions of people, you understand this, are going to know pretty much all at the same time that they're not going to make it, that they won't make it, that something, the environment has turned against them.
I don't believe that for a minute. It's bullshit. How do I know that? Because it is bullshit. Sing that song to somebody else.
Yeah, to me, I mean, my conceptualization that I come up with, and it's really, you know, it's not unique. It's just the terminology I place on it. And based upon experiences that I won't actually go into here, is that our development is from a stage of undifferentiated wholeness to differentiated wholeness. You know, this the time in the womb where, you know, as you say, it's like, well, there's a separation, but the time in the womb where at least in our experience of existence in the entire, you know, story of our, you know, our actual lives, our life cycle pattern, whatever it is, the womb, there's oneness, there's wholeness, but it's undifferentiated. There's no self, there's no other. And then you learn there's a self and another, then that leads to the state of dissociation. But then you reassociate when you heal that wound of dissociation, that trauma, and you go through several stages of that through life, until you learn to be separate, yet not, yet still maintain a connection to your wholeness with other people. And the lesson to me through life, if I wanted to put a theme that I've had, it's, you know, I'll periodically find another person that I have a lot in common with, and it's like we're very, very close and tight knit for a while, and then I'll slowly begin to see ways in which we're different. And that can either lead to a falling out, or I can appreciate those differences and still remain friends with that person. And if you're, you know, if you're more developed and mature, of course, you're able to deal with people who are more different than you, yet still recognize your common humanity and experience that wholeness and sense, leading to a sense of compassion, empathy, however you want to put it, yet still also retain your somewhat differentiated, you know, separate identity, even though you're not completely, totally, truly, literally separate. In the same sense, you're not also completely at one with another person. So it is, right, as you say, a very delicate balance, and that is the overall theme of all the lessons that I, you know, that I've felt like I've had in life. If I had to tell you exactly what the theme of everything was, it would come down to that, basically.
It's like that irreconcilable tension there when you're trying, like, I think Keith was describing it, when you're trying to maintain two ideas at the same time,
yeah,
and the temptation is almost irresistible. You have to go one way or the other.
Right.
The cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, to actually be able to stay in that, what we would experience as cognitive dissonance.
It's interesting that the that, as you said, Phil, that you start out in this kind of as the fetus in the womb and undifferentiated, and then when you're born, you're separated, or at least in some sense. And then, you know, as you get into like adolescence or you know, early adulthood, people tend to get pretty, you know, extremely sort of individualistic and read Ayn Rand books and stuff like that. And then as you mature a little bit, ideally, you would begin to fuse or synthesize those two ideas. It sort of reminds me, it reminds me of this educational idea where what you, I forgot who it was, but basically the idea is that you teach children in the order of the flow of civilization. So when they're in kindergarten, first grade, excuse me, you're teaching them about the Egyptians and those ideas, and then through to the Greeks and to the Romans, and then, I don't know, when they're 12 years old, the medieval age or the Renaissance, and you sort of progress through history as they progress, you know, into adulthood.
Yeah. That would be interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
I just thought it would be fun to raise a kid, like, you know, in a cave and not let them see any sign at all of technology, modern civilization, and then, you know, one day come home and say, look what I invented, the wheel! And then, you know, maybe when they're two or three or five or six, say, look what I invented, you know, fire! And then, you know, and then, you know, when they're 10, it's like, look, a television set! I just invented this! And then, you know, by the time you let them out into the world when they're 18, they think you've created everything. You are the master of the world, you know?
Right.
I mean, that would be really about the only reason I'd ever have kids would be to do something like that.
Oh, my God.
That and make them wear, when they're babies, make them wear T-shirts that say stupid baby or ugly baby on it or things like that. But, yeah. So, compassion. I mean, that to me is what it comes down to. I know we're kind of away from aliens and everything, but we got into aliens from, you know, kind of through trauma, or aliens and trauma were hand in hand here. To me, anyways, from as I understand the first two chapters that I've read, and to me, mm-hmm. I mean, trauma. What's the right way? Well, the answer would be compassion. I mean, what if you ended all trauma today? You'd still have traumatized people. Those traumatized people would require compassion in order to at least be able to continue to live a somewhat acceptable life after their experiences of trauma. You know. Whatever that trauma is, whether it's a natural trauma that just comes inevitably with life or some artificially trumped up trauma from evil human or perhaps unhuman entities, agencies, whatever that would be.
I would say that, I mean, empathy, although it's a bigger word, a different word from compassion, I would say that compassion really, like acting compassionately, can only come about through empathy, because if you just try and give people what you think they need,
right, it doesn't come from the mind. It's from the mind, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you might just be giving them what you think you need. You might be projecting onto them.
Well, I think it's. I think it's definitely a process of sort of trial and error, because I think most people assume that other people feel and see things the same way as they do until they're proven wrong, you know, through successive experiences. Oh, you don't see things that way. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, and gradually you start to realize that not everybody sees things the same way that you do, and maybe there isn't a single person who sees mm-hmm. things the same way you do. You know, in very specific ways, I guess.
And the question I would have at that point would be, and are you personally, not you specifically, but you, that person who realizes that, are you okay with that? Can you be okay with that? You can't go on living if you're not okay with that. Right. That there are people are different. But then again, you can't be completely accepting and tolerant of everyone. No one is that saintly.
Well, when we were talking earlier, I mean, I dropped this point because it seemed like we'd gone off the subject, but I feel like it's coming back again.
Yeah.
We were talking before about the empathy and, you know, the moving between that cognitive distance of moving between immersion in the group and the whole collective holographic system and existing totally separate as an isolate entity. I was wondering if there are different responses to that. Like there are, I'm always aware of oversimplifying, but it's really hard to put it into words at all if I don't. So it would seem like the majority of people are kind of comfortable with just being immersed in a group identity. So although they, to some extent, they may, like on Facebook, they may have their own little individual adornments and their personality quirks, but essentially they're really kind of comfortably immersed in this collective identity. They're not empathically tuned, but nor are they kind of at odds with the collective that they're part of, right?
Mm.
But then maybe there's this other smaller group of individuals whose tendency is the opposite towards that. And in both cases, you're talking about the inability to remain in that place of unknowing, where you're neither one nor the other, right? Like the infant that's not one with its mother, but it's not an individual being yet either. To remain in that almost intolerable state of tension of being neither one nor the other. But maybe there's this smaller group of people whose tendency is to go the other way, and that they become very kind of fiercely individualistic, like the Ayn Rand thing you mentioned, and so they would be the natural predators within this environment.
Exactly.
Indeed.
Yeah, because the predators generally live relatively, compared to the prey animals' lifestyle, relatively solitary lifestyle versus a herd animal, which of course is part of a group, travels in a group.
Right. I guess some predators are in packs, but
right. Yeah, there are differences. Rabbits, for instance, I mean, they seem to live fairly solitary, and they're one of the lowest on the whole prey ladder, predator prey ladder there. Strong. So yeah, I mean, there are differences, but yeah, that seems to be a general sort of pattern that you would see.
So, but you're talking about that tension, like, can you live with yourself? Can you be okay with seeing the other as different? Well, for the majority of people who are just part of this Facebook faceless herd, let's say, they don't have to deal with that tension because they basically do feel that everyone's the same as them. Because they get confirmation all day long.
Right. Everything on their team, everyone on their team, of course.
Yeah, sure. Well, yep. That's true. The yep. Muslims are not, and whatever. There's always going to be the
and the Democrats or the Republicans or the whoever, yeah.
Right. Whoever it is, that's true. Of course, they're not part of the whole of humanity, but they've got their herd to which they belong, and so basically they can be secure in that and resolve that or avoid that kind of tension that you're talking about. Whereas the other group, well, they are part of their own sort of elite group also, but as well as that, they kind of define themselves by their against the herd,
right?
Because by controlling it, by manipulating it, by having power over it, that also reconciles that tension, because the other is not threatening to you if you have control over it.
It sort of parallels an idea that I was wanting to get to, which is the whole how to deal with the abuser. You know, I think a lot of people, if you just talk about mind control or child abuse or something like that, they just shut down because they don't want to deal with that reality. And so they just push it away. It doesn't exist. It's not real. It's a myth, whatever. And then the other side of that, I guess the polar opposite would be, you know, we need to fucking kill these people. They need to be strung up and just destroyed. So here again, you know, what's required is, in my mind, is first just, you know, an acceptance of the reality, and then a compassion for the individual, which doesn't, as you said, does not entail sympathizing with the behavior that you know, that's occurred. That doesn't mean that you're justifying it. You're just so that, you know, is a tall order.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. It's like socially unacceptable as well. Like, if you don't talk about these things or these agendas or these individuals with at least some moral tone, with some judgment, then you're perceived as condoning it somewhere. So.
Right.
And that's why Whitley has to sort of qualify his definition there, and throw the criminals, you know, to the wolves.
Yeah. Yeah. That's. I would say that's pretty much it. Got to remain palatable to the mass public. Can't possibly let them think that you are saying.
Because most people do see things in these sort of black and white terms. They're,
right, exactly.
They feel like they're forced to take sides. You know,
right.
It's just, it reminds me of when my parents divorced when I was 14. And I think they both told me, okay, you don't need to pick sides here. But in my mind, I heard that, and I actually believed them, or I accepted what they said. But even in spite of that, I felt like I had to somehow, in order to make sense of what had happened, it felt like there had to be a bad guy somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. That's primal, isn't it?
And what it does is, just as you said, it relieves the tension that's created by the cognitive dissonance.
Well,
and that's sort of the goal, it seems.
To relieve the tension.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the inverse goal of individuation or autonomy is to actually live in that tension and accept it as inevitable and inescapable tension, like moment to moment.
Right.
Because it's, if you're thinking of the child, like a child growing up, assuming it even has a healthy enough environment that it is individuating to some extent, so it's separating from the mother and moving towards the father, it's in that environment where there is a natural tension of the masculine and the feminine, and these two figures that are guiding it, nurturing and guiding, and the child is testing its reality and its experience of itself, constantly referring back to those two figures for validation. Is, if I do this, is that okay? If I do that, what do you think of this? And that, so that process of checking outside of itself for validation is absolutely essential for a child in order to develop its own, you could say, value system, but this is much deeper, and it's not just cultural. It's not cultural at all, I don't think. It's actually just basic, inherent to survival and existence as an individual, independent organism, to have an inner sense of right and wrong, in quotes, not morally, but, you know, what's appropriate, what's functional, what's healthy behavior, and what isn't.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So, forgot where I was going with this now, but that's if we don't get that, with the good and evil,
mm-hmm.
If we don't develop our own sense of what's right for us and what's wrong, we're constantly having to refer outside. And so then if mummy says one thing and daddy says another, we can't reconcile that tension by referring within to discover what's actually true for ourselves. So then we have to just choose. We have to say, do I side with mummy or do I side with daddy? And I think this is really bringing it back, or not even back, but forward to Whitley and the aliens. We keep trying to get it back to that. My experience, at least, and I think it's his too, so it must be most people who read him, is that there is this irreconcilable tension is, you know, are they physical or are they not? Are they extraterrestrials or are they not? There's these either ors, and the answer doesn't seem to be either one or the other. Like, you can't just refer to the external clues or cues to decide what's going on here.
Yeah.
I agree.
It's unresolved.
In my own experience, which is not extensive, but was for a time intensive, and I won't go into all that here now. I think we talked about it a little bit over the years. It was always through dreams and synchronicities, which I still think is a valid way to look at things, synchronicities, that is. Right. And there wasn't really any aliens per se, but their craft or the promise of aliens or something, but no traumatic experiences. I won't go into the detail about that, but it set me off on like a path, a trail of, you know, I was given clues, it seemed. And the more I found out, the further I went, and ultimately in the end, I pretty much just reached a state where I could not resolve it. And it was just complete, intense unresolvability that made me kind of just let go of it and leave it behind, you know, not completely behind, because I still refer to it. And, you know, as I said, there's a recent experience that sort of impinges upon a lot of these things, or at least, you know, somehow intersects. But yeah, it's that non-resolution, that impossibility of resolving it, that mm-hmm. debate of, are they real? Have I just imagined these? I mean, it won't go away, and it seems to be real, but then it's not real, but then it's real, but then it's not real, but it's this, then it's that. I couldn't resolve it. I just, you know, I cannot personally resolve it. So, you know, I kind of, you know, since after getting real close to it, now I maintain, you know, I get close, but I don't get too close.
Right.
Well, in my opinion, that if there is a message, or if there's a lesson to be learned, that's precisely it right there. That there are, you know, can you be okay with not knowing, or with there being a paradox, or both being true at the same time, multiple truths on multiple levels, or not?
Yeah.
With not being able to fix reality into any kind of form and say, that's it, put it in a box, put it away, move on.
Exactly. Yeah. As I would go off looking, following these clues and trying to, feeling like I'm gonna get to the solution, there's gonna be a big reward at the end, you know? And then only to continually come up, you know, hints of it, increasingly until it's just a complete, just overwhelming sense of helplessness, mystery, inability to resolve it, and realizing either that's the message or this is just going to drive me crazy if I keep chasing it. So, you know, like you say, you know, if there's a message, that's it. Well, then I have to completely agree with that. If there's a message, either that's it or that's the only message I can pull out of that, because if I try to get anything more, it's going to, you know, I wouldn't want to say it would destroy me. I don't really care about that, but you know,
it would
drive me insane. It would drive me insane. I would go insane.
Well, I think it feels like it would.
Yeah. It feels like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but maybe that's also the part of the purpose of it, is to actually let yourself let go of those structures and those criteria
right.
by which you've been maintaining your semblance of sanity.
Yeah.
Not deliberately, but just because, the question isn't that so much, is whether you're going to stay in it, stay in the unknowing, because what you described is, you know, you got close enough to realize that this maybe was irreconcilable, that there was right. going to be no solution, and then you backed away. Well, I did the same. I mean, I've constantly been like Strieber, and the whole question of the visitors is like this black hole that I've, you know, been in the gravitational pull of, feels like my whole life, or ever since I discovered it. And I've been trying to get closer and then go through, but then pulling away and then trying to get free and then getting pulled back in again.
Right.
And so in the end, it seems like if I can't escape the gravitational pull of this question, of this mystery, then the only thing that leaves is to actually go all the way into it. It's actually to let it pull me all the way in.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because otherwise you're just constantly swimming against the current. And that's, there's got to be an element of trust or faith in that, that this isn't just some great psyop that I got tricked into obsessing over and wasting my life trying to figure it out. That it is actually the tip of a much larger iceberg, which is the universal question of, you know, who am I, or what am I, what the hell is going on here? How did I get here? Which way is up and which way is down?
Yeah. You know? Well, on that note, I think I'm going to have to go. I got to do a couple things before bed. So.
All right. You mean prepare for your abduction experience?
Exactly. Prepare for my abduction experience. Someone else's abduction experience. I've learned to abduct people. I'm on the dark side now, people.
Nice. Because I do know now, the science is perfectly clear. But the truth is, they're so far beyond civilization that they're not even in the same league as we are in that respect. They know absolute morality and they live by it. This is why they are willing to kick and to cherish. They want to be called the Grays. This is their idea. Because gray, of course, is a mixture of black and white. It's not divided into good guys versus bad guys. We're not dealing with some kind of Buck Rogers stuff here. This is real life. It's real complicated.
The word is about. There's something evolving.
This is real life.
Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here. That the revolution.
Well, the science is perfectly clear.
But to me, it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Are you strong enough? Can you take it? And the more you can take, the more they will dish out. I've lived with that all of my life.
The newspapers shout, a new style is growing.
It's a feeling of being under absolute control.
But it don't know if it's coming.
My body, questions, and memories, dark memories.
You have absolutely no life.
And I'll see you again.
You do have a life.
Yes, I've seen it before.
I have an implant in my left ear. What does it do to me? My being and my body, questions and memories, dark memories.
Some people will dance if they don't know who's singing.
Sing that song to somebody else.
Why ask your head? It's your hips that are swinging. Life's for us to enjoy. Woman, man, girl and boy, feel the pain, feel the joy. The little bits of history repeating.
And yet, I would never for a moment turn away from these hard and distressed, anguished masters, the greats. Never would I turn away from them. Never would I turn away from them. Never would I turn away from them.
Who the hell is that? Is that somebody?
You have absolutely no light. We do have a light.
I don't think I like that. I don't think I like that.
What is about? There's something evolving.
You have absolutely no light.
Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving.
We do have a light.
They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
My being and my body are questions and memories, dark memories. Are you strong enough? Can you take it? I have an implant in my left finger. What does it do to me? And the more you can take, the more they will dish out. I've lived with that all of my life. Never would I turn away from it. My being and my body are questions and memories, dark memories.
It's a feeling of being under absolute control. Sing that song to somebody else. Sing that song to somebody else. They are here. You have to understand that. They are here.